You're listening to In the Vault, a KPMG banking industry podcast series.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Liz Lamadou, a principal in KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. And today I'm joined by two banking colleagues, Sarah Gleason and Mike George, both managing directors on our Banking and Capital Markets Tax team. Welcome, Sarah and Mike.
Thanks, Liz.
Thanks, Liz.
So today we're going to talk about ASU 2023-09, which impacts tax disclosures. So we're heading into the second half of 2025, hearing a lot about this ASU. So let's start there, Mike. What is it?
Yeah, Liz, great question. So maybe just to give a high-level overview of the ASU, the FASB issued this ASU back in 2023. So it is for the improvements to income tax disclosure project. And its overall goal was to enhance the transparency and decision usefulness of income tax disclosures. The ASU does a few things. It expands the income tax disclosures to address some investor requests for more information about how a company's tax risks, tax planning, and operational opportunities impacts its overall worldwide operations, specifically for the effective tax rate and future cash flows. The FASB issued the ASU in 2023, late in the year, December 14th. But the reason it's getting a lot of attention now is it's effective for public business entities with fiscal years beginning after December 15th, 2024. So for all of our calendar year companies, that'll be their 2025 annual financial statements. So as we head into the second half of 2025 with this adoption, you know, approaching very quickly, it's starting to get a lot of attention as clients ramp up for year end.
Okay, great intro, Mike. Sarah, can you get into the details on what's changing on the rate rec?
Yeah, sure. So the rules are different for public business entities and for other entities. For public business entities, the ASU will require a tabular reconciliation of income tax expense based on the statutory income tax rate compared to the reported income tax expense using both percentages and amounts, which is a change from the historic rules. And this reconciliation is broken out into specific categories with certain reconciling items at or above 5% of the expected income tax, further broken out by nature and or jurisdiction. And for other entities, the ASU would require qualitative discussion of the nature and effect of significant differences between the statutory income tax rate and the effective tax rate by specific categories of reconciling items and by jurisdiction, but not require a tabular reconciliation. So, Mike, do you want to take these specific categories and cover what will be required there?
Sure. So the ASU establishes 8 specific predefined categories for the rate reconciliation. There's 5 specific categories for the federal jurisdiction, and this will include tax credits, non-taxable or non-deductible items, cross-border tax laws, changes in tax laws or rates, and finally, changes in valuation allowance. So for those 5 specific categories, they only apply to the federal jurisdiction. There's then a separate category for state income taxes, net of the federal effect. There's a separate category for foreign tax effects. And then there's a category for changes in prior year unrecognized tax benefits. Where it gets a little bit more complicated is there's a second layer that further breaks out some of those categories I just walked through based on the 5% threshold that Sarah shared. So for example, for federal, tax credits, non-taxable or non-deductible items, and cross-border tax laws require further disaggregation. For foreign, you must also break out your foreign tax expense by country based off the 5% threshold. And additionally, there's further disaggregation in your foreign breakout by need for any of the other categories that exceed the 5% threshold.
So when we think about the categories you just went through, Mike, what are some of the areas that may be a particular focus for banking clients?
Sure. Many of our banking clients have non-taxable or non-deductible items going through their rate rec, whether it's BOLI, tax-exempt interest, non-deductible FDIC premiums. There's a lot of permanent differences that, depending on the size, could require further breakout in the non-taxable or non-deductible items. So banking clients should now be analyzing their rate reconciliation to understand the magnitude of their permanent differences and which ones could require disclosure in the non-taxable or non-deductible items category. Another category that could be particularly impactful to our banking clients is the presentation of tax credits. As our industry commonly invests in tax credit structures and earn federal income tax credits. One area of consideration for this category is how to present tax equity investments and partnerships that are accounted for under proportional amortization. So clients may invest in pass-through entities to receive income tax credits, and they additionally receive other income tax benefits generated by the pass-through entity. Additionally, many clients account for these investments under proportional amortization, also known as PAM. So amortization expense is also going through your rate reg. The board acknowledged that an entity needs to use judgment in determining where to categorize certain reconciling items for which there's not specific guidance, including how to account for proportional amortization. As a firm, KPMG believes one acceptable presentation of the income tax credits and other tax benefits and the proportional amortization is to net the items together and reflect them all within this tax credit category. However, there may be other acceptable presentational approaches, so this should be something that clients work through with their accounting policy team and their auditors.
And Sarah, any other particular focus items for your clients?
Yeah, there's a couple more I would mention. So one is that Mike mentioned before, there's a separate category for changes in unrecognized tax benefits. That category must include changes in judgment about unrecognized tax benefits related to tax positions taken in a prior annual reporting period, including initial recognition, derecognition, or change in measurement. And further disaggregation of that category is not required, so it can include impacts for all positions and all jurisdictions worldwide. They're all grouped together in that single line item. However, there is optionality with respect to reporting the initial recognition of unrecognized tax benefits related to tax positions taken in the current annual reporting period. And there are three ways that companies could choose to reflect those impacts. So one option is you could reflect those impacts on a net basis with and in the same category as the related tax position. So for example, if a company had an uncertain tax position with respect to an R&D credit, the R&D credit reconciling item within the tax credits category would be reflected net of the uncertain tax position. Another option is to reflect the uncertain tax position on a gross basis in the same jurisdiction as the related tax position. So again, if a company had an uncertain tax position with respect to an R&D credit, company could choose to separately disclose that gross R&D credit and the associated uncertain tax position within the tax credits category. And the third option is to reflect that change in the unrecognized tax benefits category, grouped together with any changes in unrecognized tax benefits related to tax positions taken in prior reporting periods. So I think it depends on each company's specific facts, how they choose to report those changes in current year unrecognized tax benefits. And the second item that I would highlight is the foreign category. So first and foremost, for banks that operate outside the U.S., there's a requirement to separately disclose countries that meet the 5% threshold. So for banks that operate all around the world, that could be a lot of jurisdictions and result in a very long ETR reconciliation table. In addition to that more simple fact, many U.S. multinational banks operate in branch form around the world at tax rates that are higher than the U.S. statutory rate of 21%. And that dynamic includes that those foreign taxes paid often lead to the generation of foreign tax credits in the U.S., which offset what would otherwise be double taxation. And in many cases, U.S. banks actually generate more foreign tax credits than they can use, requiring a valuation allowance on that DTA. And that situation can lead to three separate reconciling items within that first layer of reconciling categories that Mike laid out before. So you would have non-U.S. taxes in the foreign tax effects category, the U.S. foreign tax credit in the cross-border category, and the valuation allowance in the valuation allowance category. And I think companies are finding that kind of peeling apart the pieces of that dynamic is challenging and really a data exercise as well as a thought exercise.
Agreed. This does seem like a big data exercise and one to get your arms around before you make some of those elections or decisions as to how it's reported.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, you mentioned that in the rate rec, there's not a required disaggregation for states. Are there any other required disclosures related to state?
There is. And so you're right. We don't have to separately disaggregate this in the rate rec, but it's still there are still some disclosures for state. So public business entities must qualitatively describe the domestic state jurisdictions that make up more than 50% of their total state tax expense. So what will happen is you'll determine your total state tax expense. You'll pretty much start from highest to lowest and add up state tax expense until you get the jurisdictions that in total make up 50% of your state tax expense. There's a couple different ways to approach this calculation. So for clients that do a state-by-state provision, they might have it a little bit easier because they'll have provision reports to leverage, which will show the total tax expense for each jurisdiction, and which will include items such as valuation allowances, tax credits, changes in tax rates, et cetera. However, many clients use a blended state provision, so gathering those inputs may be difficult to do on a state-by-state approach. So the board has noted that there is another acceptable approach to determining which states make up 50%, and it's to use more of a ETR approach. And so you can also calculate your state tax expense for this exercise just to be based off of apportionment and tax rates and exclude items such as valuation allowances, tax credits, et cetera. So for clients that use a blended state tax rate, for their provision may not have all the necessary data to do this exercise currently. So they should go ahead and get ahead of the process and think through which approach makes sense for their footnote.
Yes, and agree that the blended state rate is pretty common. So in addition to the changes to the income tax footnote, there's also some changes to the income taxes paid disclosure. Is that right, Sarah?
Yeah, that's right. So all entities are required to disclose income taxes paid, net of refunds received, for each annual period presented. And that disclosure must be disaggregated, again, by domestic federal, domestic state, and foreign. And further disaggregation across those three categories is required when the income taxes paid, net of refunds, to an individual jurisdiction is 5% or more of the total income taxes paid, net of refunds. For this purpose, each domestic or foreign, federal, or state jurisdiction is considered an individual jurisdiction. So if each entity has a separate tax-paying component that's filing separate tax returns with an individual taxing authority, all of the amounts paid by those various components to each individual taxing authority is combined when you determine the amount paid to an individual jurisdiction and whether that amount meets that disclosure threshold. And the other thing I'll note is Mike talked about the rate reconciliation impact of tax credits before. So I'll highlight that for companies that are purchasing transferable tax credits, they may include amounts paid to third parties in the income tax paid disclosure in the jurisdiction to which the credit relates. Similarly, for companies that sell transferable tax credits, they may include amounts received from third parties as a reduction to their income taxes paid for the relevant jurisdiction. So those amounts would generally be included in your consideration of the income taxes paid disclosure.
Great call out on that. So you guys mentioned at the start that this is all effective for public companies' annual periods beginning after December 15th, 2024. So essentially 2025 for our calendar year banks. But are there any transition options that banks should be thinking about?
Yeah, so I think after you've worked through all of what we've spoken about so far, you have one more decision to make, and that's how to adopt. So the ASU applies on a prospective basis to annual financial statements after the effective date. So like you mentioned, for most of our calendar year clients, it'll be for 2025. However, retrospective application for all prior periods is permitted. So if you're a calendar year company that adopts this ASU for your December 31st, 2025 annual period, you can either showcase this in your financial statements prospectively by providing a revised disclosure for the 2025 period and then continuing to provide pre-ASU disclosures for the prior periods, or you can adopt retrospectively and provide the revised disclosure for all periods that are presented in your financial statements.
And Mike, do you have a sense of where banks are landing on this? Do they seem to be thinking about prospective adoption and writing those disclosures, or are they leaning towards just putting the retrospective adoption and numerical information and not having to write those disclosures?
Yeah, great question. And I think the reaction from clients has been mixed. I have clients that are considering retrospective, and I also have clients that are considering prospective. I think one of the benefits for retrospective is it maybe makes the footnote a little bit cleaner and you have all of your periods, you know, presented in the same manner. If you do prospective, then of course you would have 2025 under the new method and prior periods under the old method. And so you could have, you know, a pretty long footnote. But at a minimum, whether you're deciding to do retrospective or prospective, I do see many of our clients modeling what their footnote would look like using 2024 financial statement information. So at a minimum, you'll have 2024 to go off of when you make that determination.
Agreed. And I would say that tax departments may find that they have a preference for either prospective or retrospective, depending on their facts. But ultimately, in many cases, the final call on that decision is not being made by the tax departments. You know, it needs to go through accounting policy, investor relations. There's a lot of people who will have eyes on this. So it may not be the tax department's final call at the end of the day.
That makes sense. And good to socialize early.
That's right.
So are we expecting any additional guidance related to this, or is this considered final?
I think the ASU is considered final. I will note, however, that an appropriation bill released by the House Appropriations Committee on July 17th of this year would prohibit the SEC from funding the FASB until the FASB withdraws ASU 2023-09. So there is a chance that this all goes away. But the House is currently in recess, so I'm not sure that we'll really know the fate of this provision until they return, at least early September. And I would caution that making a decision to wait until we have certainty could really put a lot of time pressure on calendar year-end companies to get the disclosure right for 2025 year-end financial statements if it does stand.
Agreed. And it's best to start working on this sooner than later.
Right.
That is interesting, and look forward to hearing the outcome of that and having you guys back. We can talk about this some more.
Sounds great.
So Sarah, Mike, thank you both for joining today and talking us through this. And to our audience, thank you also for joining us today. This is Liz Lamadou on behalf of KPMG's Banking and Capital Markets Tax Practice. I look forward to talking again soon.
Thanks for listening to In the Vault with KPMG. Be sure to subscribe to this series to be notified of new episodes.